Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Richard Drake about his study of the 20th century American historian Charles Austin Beard, entitled Charles Austin Beard, The Return of the Master Historian of American Imperialism. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you on the network. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Well, I teach history at the University of Montana. I've been here since 1982. I was trained as a Europeanist, but I've added American foreign policy as a research area in the writing that I do. And so I teach a range of courses, both European and American history courses. I have an active research agenda, the most recent work being Charles Beard, but I've also written extensively about Italian history, modern Italian history, with a special emphasis on the history of contemporary terrorism in that country. But my two most recent books have dealt with Robert La Follette, The Education of an Anti-Imperialist, which came out in 2013, and now most recently, the book you've just introduced about Charles Beard.
You describe a little bit your intellectual journey that brought you to the book in the beginning of it, and I thought it was very fascinating. As you already described, you started out as a Europeanist. What was it that exactly led you to Beard as a subject? Was it through the La Follette book, or do the origins lie a bit earlier than that?
Well, I think the answer to your question is that the origins of my interest in the book do lie far in the past, in my own past, but also more recently, in the La Follette book, which appeared 5 years ago. And while doing research on that book, the La Follette book, I discovered that he and Charles Beard had a very close political and intellectual relationship in the years before World War I, around the time Beard was writing his classic and most famous book, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States, which appeared in 1913. And so their relationship gave me an opportunity to learn more about Beard. And there's quite a bit about Beard in that earlier book on La Follette. But as I was doing work on the La Follette-Beard relationship, they were two iconic progressives. La Follette, the iconic progressive political leader, Beard, the iconic progressive historian of that early 20th century period. But I reflected on my first encounter with Beard as an undergraduate. I was very much taken with An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. I thought it extremely well done, very perceptive in its judgments about the main themes in American history from that founding era in our country's beginnings. When I went to graduate school, my first turn in graduate school, I discovered that the courses I was taking then really took a dim view. The professors teaching those courses took a very dim view of Beard, and I was sort of warned off of him as an unreliable historian. I think that was his image in the 1960s when I started out in graduate school. And it was only later, really through my work in Italy, I lived in Italy for a while and studied at Italian universities as I made the transition to European history. And as I encountered some of the greatest of the Italian historians, people like Gaetano Mosca, Vilfredo Pareto, Roberto Michel, these great realistic historians Italy produced in the late 19th century and early 20th century, I realized how close their perceptions were about the role of economics and the powerful role of economic elites in a political life, how close those ideas were to the ideas of Beard. And so I sort of resumed taking an interest in him, and I guess it was the experience of working on the La Follette book, encountering his relationship with Beard, that reminded me of what a deeply favorable impression Beard had made on me earlier in my life. And I decided to use the La Follette book as a springboard into the Beard book. And I think that's the best way to explain the influences that shaped my work on the Beard book.
It's interesting in that the book is very interesting in that it's not a standard cradle to grave biography. You're delving much more into Beard's ideas and another aspect of his life, which is his influence. And you begin by looking more specifically at the influences upon him. I was wondering if you could start off our examination of the book by talking a bit about Beard's intellectual growth, his upbringing, and how he came to the ideas that he had when he started writing his, you know, famous body of work.
Okay. Well, he was an Indiana farm boy, born in 1874 in corn country in Indiana. And went to DePauw University. He did his undergraduate work there, and was able, following his graduation, to enter the history program at Oxford University. His father was a wealthy farmer and businessman, and was able to afford the expense of sending his son to Oxford. And so, in 1898, Beard went off to Oxford. And spent 4 years there, really spending most of his time not in the classroom, but rather founding Ruskin College, which was a working men's college. He was very, very passionate about educational reform movements. And this would be a characteristic feature in his life throughout his career. But he also made some very important contacts at Oxford. I suppose the thinker who influenced him the most was John Ruskin. He was a very famous, probably the most famous art historian in the world. But what drew Beard to him was an 1862 book that he wrote called Unto This Last. It's a work of social criticism from a culturally conservative perspective, and this is one of the most interesting features of Beard's intellectual life, is that he starts out his career really under the influence of this cultural conservative thinker. I say it's ironic because Beard would become famous as a left-wing progressive historian, but there's always this cultural conservative core at his thought that is imparted from Ruskin's work. Now, the way Beard makes a path for himself out of political conservatism, and in Ruskin's case, there was kind of a shared political cultural emphasis in his work. But Beard encounters another Englishman by the name of John Atkinson Hobson, most famous today for a classic book that he wrote called Imperialism, a Study. It appeared in 1902. That was Beard's last year at Oxford. But this book made a profound impression on Beard. It helped him to understand the important role that economic elites play in the history of imperialism. But most significantly for Beard's intellectual growth at that time is that Hobson was a great admirer of Ruskin, but he sought to adapt Ruskin's thought to progressive causes, working men's causes, in a progressive way, female, the suffragette movement, anti-imperialist ideas. And so it's Atkinson Hobson, John Atkinson Hobson, who really leads Beard, I think, into his mature political views and thought. He always retained this core of cultural, conservative, traditional thinking about culture and thought and mores. He was never inclined toward Marxism, toward any revolutionary left-wing traditions. I think it was Ruskin who held him back from all that, and it was Hobson who was able to lead him in the direction of a more progressive interpretation of those traditionalist views. So those are the two main figures who helped to shape his outlook. I would add one other name, and it would be that of Edwin R.A. Seligman, who was a professor at Columbia University, where Beard finally ended up getting his Ph.D. in 1904. He left Oxford in 1902, transferred to Columbia University, where he got his degree, and it was there where he met Edwin R.A. Seligman, a professor who is most famous for his economic interpretation of history, sort of a non-Marxist, even an anti-Marxist economic interpretation of history. And Beard also imbibed ideas from that stream of thought as well. So three names to think of in connection with the major intellectual influences that shaped Beard's outlook: John Ruskin, John Atkinson Hobson, and Edwin R.A. Seligman.
You've identified how Beard reached his ideas, but yeah, there's a next step that follows, which is how he goes from being an academic who produces books to being this public intellectual who engages with major politicians, who is involved in the discourse on contemporary events or current events.
Right.
How does that take place during this period?
Well, Beard, in addition to being a brilliant historian, was also an enormously influential public intellectual, which means that his influence reached far beyond the academy. It's interesting to note that the lifetime sales of Beard's books totaled over 12 million copies. There's no historian I know of who can match that sales record. It's an extraordinary achievement. And I think it's a testament to the enormous favor he gained in the mainstream of society. He was not only an enormously successful academic historian, he served as the president of the American Historical Association, of the American Political Science Association. That in itself was a rare double honor and a sign of the esteem in which he was held by scholars. But in addition to that, his influence extended into the mainstream of society, into the marketplace, broadly conceived. And the book that really catapulted him to national fame and even international fame was a book I've already mentioned, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. It appeared in 1913. It was lionized in many quarters and served as a sort of the textbook example of good critical progressive historiography. Beard really became the paramount progressive historian of that time. But it also opened doors for him, writing for journals, writing for newspapers, eventually sort of in the next generation, giving radio broadcasts, appearing before Congress as an expert witness. He was the most famous historian in the country. And I think it was that book, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States, that really gave him his platform. And from then on, he was able to make a huge difference in the political and intellectual life of his time generally, not just as an academic, but as a public intellectual.
You've already referenced his friendship with Robert La Follette, and you describe in the book how when The Economic Interpretation of the Constitution came out, La Follette made sure that it received a favorable mention in his magazine, that, you know, the Promised Review didn't come out, but at least it was noted and it was praised, right, and his eyes were steered towards it. And your point to a convergence of thought between the two men. And yet, in 1917, there is a divide. And Beard has a very interesting course through the First World War that you describe in some detail. How exactly does he respond to America's entry in World War I, and why is that response so significant for his subsequent career?
It's a hugely important moment in his life and in the life of the country. America's intervention in the First World War, which occurred in April of 1917. And you're right, Beard and La Follette, who had been so close, such allies, political allies, in the years leading up to the First World War, really parted company over the issue of America's intervention in the First World War. La Follette took the lead in the U.S. Senate opposing American intervention, gave some famous speeches in opposition to America's foreign policy in the First World War. Beard, on the other hand, from the very outset of the war, took a strongly interventionist position. Now, that's the great question about his life and career, really concerns why he took that interventionist position when it would, in the context of what came before in his life and what came afterwards, it's such an anomalous act that he engaged in there. And he actually, long after he abandoned support of the interventionist policy and looked back on it as a great mistake, perhaps the greatest mistake of his career, he wrote about some of the motives that inspired him to take that position. In a famous book that he and his wife, Mary Ritter Beard, was a very important historian in her own right, and an outstanding, very influential collaborator of his in a number of books that they wrote together. Probably the most famous one that they wrote together is The Rise of American Civilization, which appeared in 1927, first edition. And it's in that book where it's almost in a confessional way, he talks about some of the reasons why he supported the interventionist movement. Partly, it had to do, as he puts it, with his own English roots. I mean, the Beard family, on both sides of his family, had an English pedigree going back many centuries. They were English immigrants coming to this country in the 18th century. In addition to that, he had lived in England for 4 years as an Oxford student and as the creator, one of the chief founders of Ruskin College, the Working Men's College I mentioned a moment ago. He made many contacts there, had many friends there. In other words, there were ties that bound him to England, and he wanted to believe them. He wanted to believe that their cause was right, and he persuaded himself that his cause was right, and he became totally committed to the British, to the Allied cause, and criticized Woodrow Wilson for not getting the United States into that war sooner than he did. Yeah, it was only in April of 1917 that we entered. The war broke out in the summer of 1914. Why were we waiting so long? Beard kept asking. And so I think those are the reasons why he embrace the Allied cause and the interventionist cause, which, of course, as you know from having read the book, he later totally repudiated those positions. But he for about 5 years, he was an ardent interventionist. He worked for George Creel's propaganda office promoting the war. He wrote books, essays, articles promoting the cause right through 1919, which is when the scales began to drop from his eyes and he began to embrace the revisionist movement, which I know we'll be talking about when you get around to asking me a question about it.
Well, one of the things I thought was interesting about that period of his life was that you describe this very enthusiastic commitment to the Allied cause, and yet it's you also talk about the nuance in it, that when two of his colleagues were accused of being pro-German, he didn't just jump on the bandwagon and champion their dismissal. He stood up and fought for them.
Absolutely. Two of his famous colleagues at Columbia University who were ardent anti-interventionists. They were pacifists. James McKean Cattell, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow Dana, very famous professors, particularly in the case of Cattell, who was a very famous psychologist. Professor Dana, well-regarded literature professor. But they were both on the opposite sides of the war from Beard. They opposed American intervention from a pacifistic standpoint. They were supporting La Follette at that point in American politics. And even though they were on the opposite side from Beard, when the president of Colombia, who was an ardent interventionist supporter of making the war safe for democracy, Nicholas Murray Butler, when he fired those two professors, Beard up and quit. He resigned his job at Columbia on the grounds that, look, politics aside, freedom of speech, freedom of expression is the lifeblood of a university. If you terminate freedom of speech, if you fire people on the basis of their political viewpoints, you kill the university. I will not be part of the school, and I'm leaving. And he resigned on the spot in October of 1917, even though he was on the side of the university president who fired those men politically. He was against him on moral and intellectual academic grounds. And this is a sign, I think, of what an independent thinker Beard was. And he had this reputation all of his life as a ruggedly independent thinker, and you could never really predict where he was going to go, because he based his judgments on not on ideology but on the facts as he understood them.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So you already talked about how after 1919 the scales fall from his eyes. Was there a particular event or moment where it happened, or was it more of a gradual evolution as the war receded into the distance?
I think the answer to that question is that it was gradual. He himself claimed in The Rise of American Civilization, which is the second most famous book he ever wrote in a hugely successful survey of American history. He claimed in that book that it was in 1920 when he realized that he had been mistaken about the war. And he points out who was responsible for converting him away from the interventionist, making the world safe for democracy, political foreign policy viewpoint. There were two names that he cited. One was John Atkinson Hobson, the same man who before the war had such an influence on him in that classic book, Imperialism, a Study. But in 1920, Hobson wrote an article for the Political Science Quarterly on which Beard served as an editorial advisor. So I knew when I was writing my book that he had read this article by John Atkinson Hobson. Why the War Had Come as a Surprise. It's a famous article, and it's the point of ignition for Beard's shift in political viewpoint about the Great War, as it was called, the World War I was called then. And Hobson just argues that, look, the problem with the standard official Allied interpretation of the war is that both sides were imperialistic. Both sides were really responsible for this war. It wasn't Germany's fault solely, as Article 231 proclaimed, but imperialist motives generated policies on both sides of the Rhine, as he put it. The other very important writer who convinced Beard, who began the process of convincing Beard that it had been a mistake for the United States to enter the First World War, that it really was not a war to promote democracy at all, that had nothing at all to do with the realities of that war. The war was about empire, it was about territories, markets, resources. And the other author, another Englishman, who inspired him to rethink his whole position about the First World War, was Philip Gibbs, British journalist, brilliant writer, the author of a book that appeared in 1920 called The Realities of War. It merits rereading today, I think. And Beard read it and found the same arguments even more fully developed than in the article by Hobson, which came out that same year, that the war had been about empire, not about democracy. Democracy was the camouflage that the United States government produced to conceal what the realities of that war were. And so I think that's where it begins. And those two authors, Hobson and Gibbs, along with many others, I mean, I mentioned them in the book, people like Harry Elmer Barnes, Max Montpellier-Glas, a German writer. There are many, many other of these revisionist authors who form what became known as the revisionist school, the revisionist interpretation of the First World War, the war being about empire, not about democracy, not about justice or freedom or any of those buzzwords that were in the air during the First World War. The war was about empire. It was about geopolitical positioning, strategy, strategic positioning. Beard becomes a very prominent part of the revisionist movement, but he becomes a prominent part of it very gradually. It took several years for him to embrace the revisionist viewpoint fully, but by the time he wrote The Rise of American Civilization, he was a total convert to the revisionist school of thinking. And for the rest of his life, he would believe that modern warfare fundamentally, at bottom, is always about economic motives in the manner described by Gibbs and some of the other revisionist authors.
How is this reflected in some of the works that he is producing in the 1930s? And to what extent are those books contributing to the broader debate that's taking place in the country about the origins of the war, America's involvement in the war, and then, of course, the looming crisis that emerges in Europe over the course of the 1930s?
The two main books by, well, there are so many important books that he wrote in the 1930s, but the two books that really deal with foreign policy specifically in the 1930s are The Devil Theory of War, 1936, and Giddy Minds and Foreign Quarrels, 1939. And by the mid-1930s, 1936, Beard feared that the United States would be drawn into war again as war clouds began to gather over Europe in the 1930s, following Hitler's accession to power in 1933. Beard sensed that war would be in the offing soon, and that the United States would be drawn into it again. And so he begins to write in opposition to that drift toward war a second time. The Devil Theory of War is the first of these two books in the 1930s, really based in large part on the Nye Committee reports, 1934 to 1936, the Nye Committee in Washington investigated the connections between the banking and financial community and America's decision to go to war in 1917. It's a very important set of documents that Beard mined, particularly for this book, The Devil Theory of War. And what he argues there is that what the Nye Committee has shown is that America went to war for these economic reasons primarily, and it will go to war again for economic reasons primarily, presenting other reasons as its true motives, but these will be at most subsidiary motives. The real reason will be promoting empire, promoting economic empire. That's 1936. In 1939, the year that the Second World War erupted, in fact, on September of 1939, the war began on September 1st that year, Beard published an article for Harper's Magazine called Giddy Minds and Foreign Quarrels, which later that year became a book, a short book of his on American foreign policy. And he repeats these arguments. The reason why that second book was so important is that the America First movement, which began in 1940, but the America First movement, in opposition to America's intervention in the Second World War, there were over 800,000 members of America First. There were more than 400 chapters of this organization. Beard never belonged to it, but he was their premier historian. His name and his books appear on all their recommended reading lists, usually at the top of their recommended reading lists. And Giddy Minds and Foreign Quarrels was at the very top of that list. And what he argues in that book is that classically, throughout history, going back to the earliest historical records, the very first historians, really beginning with Herodotus and Thucydides and coming all the way through to the present, they all have talked about how governments in difficulty, governments facing problems at home, often turn to foreign affairs as a distraction from those problems at home. Now, what Beard argued in that 1939 book is that FDR's New Deal has failed. The New Deal did not solve the problems of the Depression. In fact, in 1937, 1938, there was a resurgence of economic crisis in this country. The unemployment numbers were spiking, and other negative economic indicators revealed how ineffective the New Deal had been in solving the economic problems of the United States. Beard thought that it really only was with the onset of the Second World War and incoming war orders from Europe that enabled the United States economy to begin to overcome the ill effects of the Depression. It wasn't the New Deal. It was the Second World War that ended the Depression. And Beard feared that this was going to become, for the United States, the permanent solution to the country's economic problems. Permanent war, a permanent war economy. And this was his great fear for the United States. He thought that this was the existential crisis that America faced, to be on a permanent war status, war footing, permanent war economy, and all of this was going to be resulting from our intervention in the Second World War. All of these problems were going to be have the effect of disfiguring the American Republic and turning it into an American empire. And this is how he assessed the main political and economic trends of the 1930s. Those two books are very important by him: The Devil Theory of War and Giddy Minds and Foreign Quarrels. That last title is from a line from Shakespeare's Henry the Fourth, Part Two, when Henry the Fourth counsels his son, the future Henry the Fifth, to distract his political adversaries with foreign quarrels, take their minds off domestic issues, domestic problems. And Beard thought this was just a time-honored stratagem of leaders in difficulty at home. And he thought that this same problem was the one that FDR was facing in the late 1930s.
Now, we've been talking about his views during the 1930s going into the war, and I think it's important to stress this point that we're not just talking about somebody who is writing books that don't have an audience. You've already mentioned that they're on the reading lists of the of these various groups. You mentioned that his the book he writes in 1940, A Foreign Policy for America, it's Gerald Nye cites it on the floor of the United States Senate. So he's not just commenting on a debate, he's an active participant in it.
You know, what's so remarkable about Beard, it was for me when I was doing research for the book, to discover how many times he appeared as an expert witness in congressional hearings, both for the Senate and the House. How many times, dozens of times, his articles and books were cited in the congressional record. It's just extraordinary to realize what his power was, what his influence was, and particularly for senators like Burton K. Wheeler of Montana, who was a powerful anti-interventionist. Gerald P. Nye, you've already mentioned him, was another one, constantly citing Beard's ideas, Beard's work, bringing him to Congress to speak to the leaders about his views concerning foreign affairs. So his reach was very great in American political life, and it, as you just mentioned, also in terms of how many people were reading him, how many people were following his arguments. He had this reputation of being the truth teller. He was the truth teller, and you have to realize that in the Depression era, when the American economy had cracked up and the American economic establishment was in low standing in terms of its prestige and the honor in which it was held, the American people were looking for truth tellers. And Beard, among the historians, was the greatest of them all. And so whenever a book of his appeared, it automatically sold extremely well, many of them becoming bestsellers. Books that today, when you go back and read, for example, The Rise of American Civilization, which came out in a second edition in the 1930s, in the Depression era, an amplified edition. But when you read that book, it's 1,700 pages long. People were reading these. They didn't have television or the internet. I mean, they had to read more, I think, in those days. And they read Beard, and they revered him. His standing was really at an extraordinarily high point all through these Depression era years, especially leading into the Second World War. But then, of course, as you know, everything changed.
So what did change for Beard after Pearl Harbor? And also, perhaps more importantly, what didn't change for him?
Okay, let's start with what didn't change. after Pearl Harbor. His reaction to the Second World War was somewhat complex. In his private letters, and by the way, he and his wife burned all of their personal papers, so much of his correspondence just isn't available to us. But letters that he wrote to people have survived in various collections, and we know from those letters and from articles that he was writing, and even from some of the books that he was writing during the war years, he continued to have a critical view of American foreign policy. He continued to think that, yes, Hitler is as evil as his worst enemies say that he is. Beard has no doubt about that. He detested fascism. He hated Nazism. He wrote very censoriously about Hitler, Mussolini, Tojo. He has no brief for any of them. But he clings to this idea that World War I and World War II are really one war with a 20-year armistice in between. They're both about the same thing. They're both about imperialism. They're both about who is going to get to rule the poor at the end of the conflict. He clings to this viewpoint that he obtained from the revisionist school in the immediate aftermath of the First World War. He clings to that, but he doesn't write vociferously about this. I think for a couple of reasons. One, he has a son, his son William, who was fighting in Europe in the Second World War. So this I think, had a dampening effect on any inclination that he might have to voice his views with his customary directness and firmness and aggressiveness. Also, he came to see the reason to defeat Hitler. He does accept that as a legitimate war aim, but he always senses that that's not the real war aim. He argues that with FDR claiming in famous speeches and famous documents that the Second World War is about the four freedoms, Beard says, I don't think that's what the war is about. Look who our primary military ally is. It's Joseph Stalin, the worst mass murderer in history, the greatest dictator, the worst dictator in the world, much worse as a mass murderer as of December 7, 1941, than Hitler was. The Holocaust did not get underway until the Wannsee Conference of January 1942. And so Beard says, I just don't think that the war is about freedom. You can't claim feasibly that the war is about freedom when your principal ally is Joseph Stalin. The war has to be about something else. I think that something else really has to do with the standard reason why nations go to war, why they certainly went to war in World War I, and why they're going out to war again. The British and the French trying to hold on to their ill-gotten gains from the Treaty of Versailles. The Germans trying to reach out for Lebensraum in Eastern, Central and Eastern Europe. It's about empire again. We Americans do not want to become involved in that. To become involved in that is to touch pitch, and we must not do that. The American Republic will be besmirched by this war. The consequences of this war are going to be horrendous, and we must stay out of it. Now, as I say, all of that is presented in a very subdued way, in more openly in letters, less openly in what he was publishing at this time. But then, once the war was over in 1946, he begins to produce a series of two books in which he will speak his true mind fully. And that is when I think his reputation as a historian took a terrific hit, from which it has not recovered until this day.
I thought it was especially fascinating how during the war he formulates a connection with Herbert Hoover.
And oh, absolutely.
And you go into Herbert Hoover's own positions on the war, and of course his unpublished book. But it was interesting about how Hoover approaches it. Initially, they seem to be politically very easy, because as you explained, Beard still remains true to his progressive views domestically, but Hoover finds that he and Beard share very common ground when it comes to this question of Roosevelt's handling of the war, the origins behind the war, and they have this very interesting would you say go so far as to say friendship, or maybe just an association that continues on through the rest of Beard's life?
I think it was a friendship, and in a very close one in some important ways. I mean, Hoover trusted him with very important documents that he furnished to Beard regarding the war and regarding Hoover's own understanding of the war and why Hoover strongly opposed American intervention in that conflict on the grounds that Stalin was every bit as evil as Hitler, if not more so. And what we were doing, fighting a war with Joseph Stalin, could in no way be presented in any kind of realistic way, anyway, as a war for freedom. It really was a war for power reasons, as Hoover understood it. So, yes, they formulated similar views about the Second World War. They were steadfast allies in the post-war period. Beard was constantly encouraging him to complete his memoir, Hoover's memoir of the war, which Hoover never did in his lifetime. The book was published posthumously. A Betrayal of Freedom is the title of it. That title, it tells you all you need to know about his interpretation of the Second World War and Roosevelt's role in it. Beard, of course, published his books. The two big ones that he published were American Foreign Policy in the Making, 1932 to 1940, and President Roosevelt and the Coming of the War, 1941, with this marvelous subtitle, A Study in Appearances and Realities, in which he tried to show how, and Hoover, who was in a correspondence with Beard, as Beard was writing these books, strongly encouraged him in this interpretation of American foreign policy in the Second World War, that the war really had been fought for reasons that had not been announced by the government. The government was talking about four freedoms. They really were talking about protecting corporate capitalism worldwide in ways that Beard thought would be the undoing of the country. That this really was the outcome of the Second World War for Beard. That at the end of it, the United States was the world's really only real superpower. The Soviet Union was a superpower of a secondary rank, certainly in economic terms. The United States was the dominant nation on Earth, and the dominance would be expressed by the expansion of the American military presence worldwide, hundreds of military, eventually some 800 military bases would be established. Why, Beard was asking in 1946, 1947, 1948, he died in 1948, but he already could see the trend that the Cold War was taking, that the United States would be on permanent planetary guard duty. Guard duty for what? To supervise, to defend, to augment the corporate capitalist structure, which in Beard's view meant that the United States, that the American people would forevermore be on war alert. They would be permanent war for permanent peace. That's a famous saying associated with Beard's name. But this would be the principal outcome, not only of the Second World War, but the principal outcome of American life forevermore. And of course, right down to 2019, we can see how prophetic a historian Beard was. One of the reasons I wrote this book was to alert the American people that in Charles Austin Beard, they have in the work of Charles Austin Beard, they have a resource that will enable them to understand how the United States reached the point where it now finds itself in the world, permanent war for permanent peace, constant terrorism, constant revolution, constant warfare. And this has become the fate of the American people. Beard worried about this in 1946, 47, 48, and prophesied that this would be our destiny. And we would have to try to pull back from that. And I think his work is a call. It's an inspiration for us to do just that.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Well, I'm working on a couple of things. I've taken a great interest in a poet by the name of Robinson Jeffers, who the same year that Beard wrote President Roosevelt and the Coming of the War, 1941, that same year, Jeffers wrote a famous anti-war poem called The Double Axe, which I have described in a paper I gave not long ago at the Robinson Jeffers Association conference, which is held annually in Carmel, California. This is Beardianism set to the music of poetry. So I have a lot of interest in him, and I'm writing some articles about him, one of which will be appearing shortly in Jeffers Studies. The other project I'll mention here very briefly is work I've done for many years on Mark Twain as a critic of American empire. I've done quite a bit of research in the Twain papers at Berkeley, California. All the papers are housed there magnificently. It's a wonderful collection. I've made a couple of research trips there, and I'm in the process of gathering my thoughts for a book about him. That would be really part of a trilogy that I have in mind of books about American critics of the country's imperialism. Robert La Follette, Charles Austin Beard, and then finally Mark Twain.
Well, it sounds like you have quite a full plate of research there.
We never stop.
Well, Richard Drake, thank you for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much, Mark.